Thanks, Tom, for the introduction. I was having a chat with Andy Lowe some weeks ago, and we decided we would securitize these two talks. In the end, we decided to take all the equations out of his talk, and we'd cram them into my talk. Which is the high-grade one and which is the low-grade one? Well, he came first, I came second, so you can decide for yourself. I had one point of dispute, though, with his talk a little bit earlier. You may have noticed in his suggestion that there be a small tax placed on derivative transactions to fund master's programs and so on and so forth. It's a nice idea, but I think it should be a big tax. Well, tonight I'm going to talk about information flows in financial markets. We're going to be concerned about price changes in financial assets. One of the major determiners of price changes, and arguably the major determiner of price changes, is new information. When new information hits a financial market, whether it's actually true information or misleading or even bogus information, then the prices of related assets will adjust in response, and then they'll move again when new information is presented to the market. There are many different ways in which information can impact prices. It can impact those particular securities that are affected by the information. In other situations, one can have situations where the whole market is affected. One can have macroeconomic information that will change investor attitudes towards risk, for example, affect the utility function of the representative agent, and so on and so forth. Well, the role of information, I think, is clear on an intuitive basis, but the question is, how can we model the flow of information using mathematical tools? And in particular, there's the important question, what is the information actually about? So in this talk, I'll discuss some of the issues involving the modeling of the flow of information in financial markets, and I'll present some elementary models about information that are applicable in various situations. In particular, I'll be looking at the problem of correlation modeling, and this is clearly an area where we all feel, I think, that back to the basics approach is appropriate. And I think after Andy Lowe's talk, it's clear that this is an area where we're going to have to think more deeply in the future. Finally, I'll mention a few remarks about statistical arbitrage strategies. This is an area I don't think that's going to go away, and it's interesting to explore this mathematically. The work that I'll present today is based mainly on a set of papers with various co-authors whose contribution I would want to acknowledge, in particular Dorje Brody and Andre Makrina, with whom they're several papers. I'll flash this up again at the end. There's a nice paper by Rutkowski and Yu that develops some of the work here. And then there's also, I should mention, a recent paper with Dorje Brody, Mark Davis, who's here in the audience, Robin Friedman, on the material relating to statistical arbitrage. Let me begin with the following remark. When models are constructed for the pricing and risk management of complicated financial products, the price dynamics of the underlying simpler financial assets are often simply assumed, modulo some freedom in the form of parameters or functions, but the processes are simply assumed on a kind of ad hoc basis. We're all familiar with the geometric Brownian motion models and the simple Ito calculus type models for securities prices, and if you open any sophisticated book on mathematical finance, then there'll be a kind of standard model presented where you have a series of assets being driven by Brownian motion or perhaps by more complicated processes, and that's just assumed from the outset to be the market, and then the investigation proceeds from there. But what we would like to do is to go more deeply into what actually determines the shape of these models that we're going to use for the basic asset prices. So there are perhaps three main ingredients that go into the modeling of asset prices, and how you chop these up is sort of a matter of taste, but I think it's convenient to say that we have, on the one hand, the modeling of the cash flows that the assets provide, and then we have the modeling of the market filtration. This is essentially the flow of information to the market. And then finally, we have the modeling of the pricing kernel, or state price density, or stochastic discount factor, which at a macroeconomic level determines the discounting, the risk aversion, and so on of the class of market participants. Now, what follows? One can't solve all the problems at once, but what follows will concentrate mainly on A and B, and we'll look at examples of how to model the filtration explicitly using a class of processes that we'll call information processes. And in doing so, we'll look at a variety of different applications that involve credit, equity, insurance, and statistical arbitrage. For simplicity, right at the outset, we'll assume that the interest rate system is deterministic. This is the default-free interest rate system. I'm not sure that there still exists a default-free interest rate system, but we'll assume that it's deterministic. And we'll also assume that there's a global pricing measure that has been fixed, the risk-neutral measure. So we're not going to discuss issues about how that comes about and how that's fixed. Now, we'll make the usual assumption of modeling the financial markets with the specification of a probability space, which is fixed. But rather unusually, instead of assuming that the filtration is simply given, we're going to actually model the filtration explicitly. So we'll come back to that shortly. Now, the absence of arbitrage implies that the discount bonds can be represented in a standard way involving the specification of the initial yield curve, which we'll assume to be given. We won't assume that the market is complete. We'll assume that that although derivatives can be priced, that's essentially the existence of the risk-neutral measure. We won't assume that they can necessarily be hedged. Now, just as a piece of terminology, since we're actually going to model the filtration rather than just assume it, so to speak, into existence, then we'll say that we're working with an information-based framework, and that's what we mean by an information-based framework. So to be more specific now, let's consider some examples. We'll look at a financial contract that entitles the holder of the contract to a set of random cash flows. For simplicity, we'll assume that these take place on a set of fixed dates, which I'll call TK, and K runs from 1 to N, and could be infinite, but let's, for simplicity, make it finite. And then we have a set of random variables, which I'll label as DTK. TK is the date, and D is the random cash flow that occurs on that date. Then, given our various assumptions about the deterministic interest rates and the existence of the risk-neutral measure, then it's a straightforward enough matter to write down the value of that asset, which we'll call S. We have an indicator function which determines which of the cash flows have already been taken place, and we ignore those. And then we consider the discounted conditional expectations of the cash flows in the risk-neutral measure, given the information that we have at time t. So this is the standard risk-neutral valuation formula. And if we already have the filtration at our disposal, then in a sense, that's the end of the story. All that remains is the sometimes complicated business of calculating the conditional expectation and then working out the properties that follow on from that. But essentially, the problem is solved. But we're going to step back and say, okay, well, let's not assume that we already know the filtration. We're going to model that. So what does it mean to model the filtration? Well, now we're going to embark upon the process of modeling the filtration. So here's the idea. There are various ways that one can pursue this, but this is one that after our investigations we found is particularly nice, and it sort of fits in with various other approaches that have been pursued in connection with asset pricing. So we'll introduce a set of independent random variables, which I'll call market factors, or let's call them X factors. So these are labeled by dates. The intuition here is that an X factor that's labeled by a particular date will be revealed on that date, and it'll be, its value will be unknown up to that date. But since we don't have a filtration yet, we can't quite say that, but we're going to construct the filtration in such a way that that's the case. And then for each cache flow, we'll assume that it'll be dependent on the various market factors that are applicable up to that date. So for some given value of k, then dtk will depend on xt1, xt2, and so on and so forth, all the way up through xtk, but not the x factors that are going to be revealed at a later stage. So this will be consistent with our modeling for our filtration. The x factors might be vector valued, a kind of collection of random variables, or they might just be single random variables. For all of our applications that follow in this talk, they'll be single random variables. Now, once we've constructed the X factors, and then we want to introduce the dependence of the cash flows on the X factors in a more explicit way. And this diagram sort of illustrates the idea. We'll introduce a function, which we'll call delta, for each date tk. We'll call that a cash flow function. So in the picture here, there's time 0. That's always the present. Time t is the time at which we're trying to value the security that pays off this stream of dividends. And then at time t1, we have the first cash flow. That depends on the x factor xt1. Time t2, we have the second cash flow. That depends, well, on the xt1, which has already been revealed, but also on the new x factors, xt2, that are revealed at that time, and so on for the various cash flows that follow. Now, how do we know how to specify what the cash flow, what X factors the cash flows depend on? Well, we say that's the job of the financial analyst in the most general sense, to determine the relevant X factors in the model, to assign appropriate a priori probabilities to the X factors, and in general determine the dependence of the cash flow functions. This isn't an easy job, of course. So just to get into the spirit of it, we'll look at a couple of simple but not irrelevant examples. The first example here will be a simple credit-risky coupon bond. So we'll assume that there are two coupons and that there's no recovery on default. So the first cash flow is given by C, that's the value of the coupon, times an X factor. This is a simple X factor that can just take on the values 0 and 1 with a certain a priori probability, P1, which is given here. And then the second cash flow is given by the coupon plus the principal. But it's multiplied times a product of two X factors, XT1 and XT2. The idea here is that if the first payment fails for any reason, then since there's no recovery, then that's it for the bond. And so one, if the first payment fails, then the second payment will also fail. But if the first payment comes through, then there's still a possibility that the second payment might not come through, so therefore we have a product of the two X factors there. Now, let's look at a slightly more complicated example. This would be the same sort of setup, but we allow for the possibility of recovery. So in that case, we have the coupon times the first X factor, but then we have another term, which is the involves 1 minus XT1. So that sort of kicks in if the full coupon isn't paid. And then in that case, we get some recovery R1. If the first coupon isn't paid, then the principal immediately becomes due. And so after you allow for some delays and so on and so forth, then you recover some fraction of the coupon that's due and the principal that's due. We'll call that factor R1. So that's the first recovery factor. On the other hand, if the coupon is paid, then we get the full C, but there's still a possibility that the coupon and the principal aren't paid fully the second time around. So we have a product of the XT1 and XT2. If XT2 is equal to 1, then we get C plus N, but if XT2 is equal to 0, then In that case, we get only a certain percentage of the final coupon and principal that are due, and that's RT2. So that way we can model the X-factor structure for the two payoffs of a slightly more complicated instrument like this simple credit risky coupon bond with recovery. So that's how we model the cash flow structures using the X-factors. Now let's introduce the idea of information processes. Well, this is actually a rather general idea, but I'll give you the specific example that kind of motivates the general idea. So we're going to look at some time t less than one of the dates tk, and we'll introduce an information process that I'll call psi. So we label psi with the variable little t and the fixed date big tk. And the information process takes this form. There's a parameter sigma, which can be thought of as the flow rate of information about the unknown X factor. Then there's a factor itself, X. And then there's a multiplicative factor of T here, which corresponds to the fact that as time passes, the signal, so to speak, gets bigger and bigger. And then in this remaining term, it's added on as a standard Brownian bridge over the time from 0 to the time TK. So it starts at 0, and then it finishes at the value 0. So since it finishes at the value 0, then this means that from the knowledge of psi, we can, at time big TK, we can fully recover the value of the X factor. So in that sense, the X factor becomes revealed if the market participants have access to the information process, which they monitor. Also, since the Brownian bridge tends to kind of start to shut down as we approach big T, this corresponds to the idea that the X factor becomes more and more sort of clear in the minds of the market participants as we approach the date at which the X factor becomes revealed. So we'll assume that the X factors and the Brownian bridges are independent. That gives a kind of nice structure. Then the Brownian bridges represent the market noise. And only the first term corresponds to the sort of true signal or market information. So that's the sort of general setup. And to construct the market filtration, what will it do now is to assume that the filtration is generated by the entire collection of market information processes, referring to the various X factors that determine the various payments of the securities that are being modeled. So we say that by saying that the sigma algebra FT is generated by the processes from time 0 running up to time T, sort of all taken collectively. So in this scheme, this means by construction that the information processes are all adapted to the filtration. But of course, the underlying Brownian bridges are not adapted to the filtration. If they were, then of course you would immediately know what the values of the X factors are. But as it stands, the X factors are only revealed at time TK. That's to say, at each time TK, the market factor XTK then is FTK measurable in the particular filtration that has been constructed. So that's the sort of idea about how we go about constructing the filtration. Now, the reason that we've chosen this particular model, apart from the fact that it satisfies various nice sort of stylistic properties, is that it has the property that the information processes are all Markov. And this turns out to be useful in various calculations. It means that rather complicated a priori path-dependent calculations can be reduced down to calculations involving simple conditional expectations that in some cases one can carry out analytically. And I'll proceed, in fact, immediately to give an example of such an analytic calculation. We'll look at a slightly more complicated structure in this case. For simplicity, we'll consider an asset that pays just a single dividend. So maybe this is some kind of limited partnership company that winds up at a certain time and pays just one dividend to all of the shareholders. And this cash flow will be called D. And for simplicity, we'll assume that it depends only on a single X factor, and we'll let that X factor be the dividend itself. So we sort of strip away some of the structure here. And in this case, we'll assume that X is a continuous non-negative random variable, and that we're given the a priori probability density, which we'll call P. And what we want to do is to calculate the value of this asset at time little t. So that's the discounted conditional expectation. Now, by the Markov property, we don't need to know the history of the information process from time zero up to time t. In fact, it suffices to know just the value of the information process at time little t. And then this can be worked out essentially by using a version of the Bayes formula. So we do this in two steps. We can express the price of the asset in terms of a conditional probability density function, which I'll call pi. So pi t of x is a random variable, and it represents the conditional probability density given the information up to time little t. And here's the explicit formula for it. It has an interesting structure. It's not something that you sort of see in the textbooks, but it's the key thing to note here is that the conditional probability density is given by a kind of a quotient. There's a normalizing factor in the denominator, and then the numerator involves the probability density function p. There's an exponential, and we see in particular the random variable corresponding to the value of the information process appears in the conditional probability density function as the determiner of the value of the density. So what this means is that if we're given the value of the information at time little t, then that determines the conditional probability, then we can do the integral, and that tells you what the value of the asset is. So we can take this a step further and look at the dynamics of the asset. It's kind of usual in discussions of finance to start with some specified dynamics for the asset. One's given a form for the drift and the volatility as a kind of stochastic differential equation. If you're lucky, you can solve it. If you're unlucky, well, you can't solve it, but then you do numerical simulations and you work with that and so on and so forth. But we're going to sort of do this in reverse. We can, in fact, start with the explicit solution, so to speak, for the asset price. But we'll now differentiate that in order to work out the dynamics. And this has some surprising features. So if we take the expression on the previous slide, and let me go back briefly, and we take this expression for pi, we put it into this integral, and then we differentiate s using the usual rules of Itô calculus. So we have the Itô quotient formula that has to be taken into account. Then after some manipulation, we get a formula for the dynamics of s. Now the drift has no surprises, because after all, we've assumed risk-neutral probability, and then the usual laws of no arbitrage imply that in the risk-neutral probability, the drift is going to be the interest rate. So all the action is here in the term involving the volatility. So we see that the volatility is up to some multiplicative factors given by the conditional variance of the x factor. And then that's the coefficient of dw. Now, what is this w? I haven't mentioned anything about w up to this point. It seems natural enough that that the Brownian motion driving the asset should appear here, but I haven't said anything about Brownian motion so far. Well, the point here is that this FT adapted process w that appears here is not something that is specified exogenously, but it's actually defined, so to speak, in the model itself. We do a computation when we work out the derivative of s using the Itô calculus. We find that it takes this form where the volatility terms involve d of this process w, which is defined in terms of psi and in terms of the conditional expectation of x, which we already know involves psi, by this expression. And then it's a calculation. It's essentially a theorem of filtering theory that the process w that you work out this way is a standard Brownian motion with respect to the filtration generated by the information process, which is our market filtration. So in this way, we don't sort of put in the w which drives the asset, but we deduce the w that drives the asset, and it's kind of a byproduct of the calculation. We work out that w is driven by a standard Brownian motion. So let's pursue matters a little bit further. What I'll discuss now is a kind of model for stochastic volatility. So we're going to consider an asset that is driven by the dynamics that are associated with a number of different dividends. So we'll let the DTKs be the various dividends. In this case, the price is given by the sum of the indicator function to see whether T is less than the big T times the discounted conditional expectation of the dividend, summing over all of the dividends. And we introduce the cash flow. And after a calculation, we end up with this slightly more complicated expression for the dynamics of S. At first glance, it looks complicated, but after you inspect it for a moment, you can deconstruct it into pieces that all make sense. The drift term involves, on the one hand, the interest rate, and on the other hand, a set of jumps that take place when the dividends are paid, so that's not surprising. And then we have a slightly more complicated volatility term, which now, rather than simply being the conditional variance, involves the a set of terms involving the covariance of the X factor XTJ with the cash flow function in which it appears. And then we have a collection of Brownian motions that arise, which are called WJ, one for each different X factor. And these Brownian motions are defined in terms of the associated information processes. So what one sees is that in the case of an asset driven by a number of Brownian motions, there's a kind of link between that situation and the case where you have an asset that has multiple dividend payments involving a collection of X factors. In fact, it suffices for the asset to be driven by, to have a single a dividend payment, but driven associated with a number of different X factors for there to be a collection of Brownian motions driving the asset. And the point there is that this gives rise to a general unhedgeable stochastic volatility. The asset is in effect dependent in a fundamental way on a collection of Brownian motions to be driving it. And so as a consequence, if one builds a derivative on the asset, then it can't necessarily be hedged in a position with a position in just the underlying asset itself. So as a consequence, you see that one is led to a rather specific kind of set of structures for stochastic volatility. And it would be natural, you know, in the longer term to examine the stochastic volatility processes that result in such a model and see to what extent they conform to the type of stochastic volatility that is actually observed. So that's one project that can be pursued. Now we can pursue the idea a little bit further. If one has stochastic volatility, then this leads us on to the issue of the dynamics of correlation. While in the modeling activities that have been pursued over the last decade, there have been a number of rather good stochastic volatility models proposed and are used and have been used by a number of different financial institutions. Not quite the same thing can be said for correlation modeling, which has tended to be done on a rather more sparse and ad hoc basis. Questions have been asked about the ultimate usefulness of coupling methods as a basis for correlation modeling. And so it certainly makes sense to look at, in a fresh way at correlation modeling. And here's one angle that one can take. Just to sort of set the scene, I'll develop an X factor model and look at it. This will be a situation rather similar to the model that we looked at earlier, but in this case we'll look at a situation where we have a pair of bonds each making a single payment. So you can think of these as credit risky zero coupon bonds, or more generally, any kind of security that pays has a single random payment at a fixed time. So the first bond will have a cash flow D at T1, and the second bond will have a cash flow DT2 at time T2, which occurs slightly later. And what we'll propose are these two structures for the payoffs. The first payoff will have a principal N1 and then a recovery R1 that is paid if the principal isn't paid, if there's a default. And the first X factor takes the value 0 or 1 and determines whether the first bond pays or not. Then in the second case, we can allow for different recovery values depending on whether the first bond defaults or not. So the situation to have in mind, just to make it a bit more vivid, is the case where the first cash flow represents a bond payment made by some large company, let's say a car company that maybe is in risk of going bust. And then across the street from this huge factory is a restaurant that serves the workers their lunch, and they have some outstanding bond, and let's say it's has one payment which is due to be made, and that's DT2. Now, the situation about the finances of the little restaurant are going to depend rather crucially on what happens to the big company. If the company folds, then there's a good chance that the restaurant might fold. But on the other hand, if the company, the big company, survives, then the restaurant may still collapse. After all, the manager of the restaurant may embezzle the cash register and take all the funds down to South America or something like that. So we have to analyze the various scenarios. So the first term here represents the case where the car company survives and the manager behaves nicely and the full payment of the principal is made, that's NT2. In the second situation, we have a good manager, so he's doing his duty, but nevertheless, the first company, the car company, fails, and so the restaurant can't manage without the customers, and so as a consequence, they default, and RA is the recovery that is obtained in that case. In the second situation, the car company keeps going, but the manager runs off with the contents of the cash register. And in this case, there's a different recovery. The recovery would be rather high in this case because, after all, the car company is still there. So a new manager can move in, buy the restaurant. Maybe they'll deal with the situation about the bond. And so a fairly high recovery is paid. The third case is the worst possible situation where the car factory closes and the manager of the restaurant runs off with all the money. In that case, RC would be rather small. There's not going to be any money left to pay off the bondholders. So that's our X factor structure in this sort of hypothetical situation. So let's look at the dynamics of the two bonds. So I'll call S1 the price of the first bond. And it's given by the discounted conditional expectation of D. T1, and when we work out the dynamics, then, it's just the formula that I gave a little bit earlier, and it involves a Brownian motion W1 and the conditional variance of the X factor XT1. Now, if we look at the dynamics of the second bond, this is the bond of the restaurant, then the situation is a little bit more complicated because DT2 depends on these two different X factors. And so as a consequence, when you work it all out and gather the various terms together, you find that the dynamics depend on the original Brownian motion, W1, but also on a second Brownian motion, W2, which is associated with the second X factor. And so as a consequence, one sees that the dynamics of the two bonds have a common Brownian driver. There's some overlap. That's this W1 term. So as a consequence, we can just directly compute the dynamic correlation between the two assets. So that's given by taking the product of the DSs and dividing by the square roots of the squares. And when one turns through the calculation, eventually one's left with a nice explicit formula for the dynamic correlation of the asset. So in this sort of approach, you see that it's not necessary to assume kind of a correlation in the dynamics of the asset, but rather by going back to something more basic, namely assuming a sort of commonality in the factors that are resulting in the payoffs of the two different bonds, one can eventually deduce an explicit expression for the resulting correlation between the two dynamics. Now, so far I've discussed the type of information processes that would be appropriate for analyzing stocks and bonds and other assets that have sort of nice dynamics associated with Brownian motion, but we can extend the idea to look at other classes of assets, and this involves introducing other types of information processes. So here's an example. This is what I'll call gamma information. So in this case, we have a random variable x, which we'll assume to be positive, and we introduce an information process psi, which this time has a kind of multiplicative structure. So we have an x factor x times a so-called gamma bridge. Now, what is a gamma bridge? Well, a gamma bridge is can be modeled as a quotient of a gamma process with its value at the later date, so gamma little t divided by gamma big T. Now, we'll assume the gamma is a sort of standard gamma process with a rate m, so that's essentially the fact that the mean of the gamma process is m times little t. I'll recall that the gamma process is a positive increasing Levy process and purely discontinuous, and at each time little t, the random variable gamma t has a gamma density, and it's of this specified form. So this fixes my conventions, and this is where the parameter little m comes into play. And you can see that the gamma bridge has the property that it starts at the value 0, since the gamma process starts at 0, and then as gamma little t works its way up to time big T, then you get the value unity. So the gamma bridge runs from 0 to unity. So since the gamma bridge is multiplying the random variable x, which is itself assumed to be positive, you can see the gamma information is applicable in situations where the random variable x represents the total accumulation in some irreversible gains process. Now, the point is that there are many examples in finance where one's dealing with irreversible gains processes, and they arise in an insurance context, for example, the total number of accidents or fatalities of a certain type taking place over a given period, or maybe the total number of sales achieved, or the total amount of water or gas or electricity consumed over a period, or the total amount of emissions emitted over the given period. And there are many different examples. And we can consider modeling all of these different sort of examples using gamma information. So in particular, we're interested in financial contracts for which the payoff is given by some function of the terminal value of the random variable x t. So what we want to do then is to take the conditional expectation of d, and given all the information up to time little t, and we'll assume that the filtration is generated by the information process, as in the previous example. Now, it turns out rather miraculously that the gamma information process also has the Markov property. The people who work in finance are so accustomed to working with Markov processes that they get rather spoiled and forget the fact that, generally speaking, one doesn't work in the world of Markov processes, and they're rather special. But nonetheless, here is another example, and it's kind of it's a non-trivial calculation to show that it's a Markov process. It involves the well-known but rather subtle fact that if you take the ratio of the values of the gamma process at two different times and then consider the value of the gamma process at the later time, then these two random variables are independent. And once you have that property, then you can show the Markov property relatively straightforwardly. Now, here I've plotted an example of a gamma bridge. This will give you a kind of feeling for what these processes actually look like, somewhat stylized. So there's time going from time zero up to time one. And then this is the value of the gamma bridge going up the other axis. And you can see there are lots and lots of jumps. Generally speaking, it forms a kind of path whose mean you can see is a sort of straight trajectory going from zero up to one. But sometimes you have sluggish paths where not much happens at the outset, and then you get some big jumps towards the end. That's the sort of thing that the insurance companies worry about, you know. And then you get other situations where you get lots of big jumps at the end, at the beginning, and then relatively little action later on. And in the intermediate case, well, the jumps can happen at various times. So you can think of the gamma bridge process as sort of modeling the arrival of the events that are going to cause the accumulation. And the random variable x is what determines the overall magnitude of the eventual accumulation. So in an insurance context, this could be losses, but this can also apply to losses in financial contracts where you're essentially counting the number of hits that can occur, which can be of various magnitudes. For example, losses on a trading book. So we can go ahead and do the calculation. The value of a gamma bridge has a beta distribution, so this is something that we can get our hands on and work with fairly explicitly. So in particular, let's take an example for which x is discrete and takes on a collection of values, xi, for various values. Then in that case, if the payout d is given by x itself, we can work out the conditional expectation of x given the most recent value of xi, since xi is a Markov process. And after a calculation, one's led to an explicit expression for the value of the asset, and that's given here. So you can see once again that the value of the asset that pays the terminal value x can be expressed in terms of the value of the information process given at the time t. So this allows you to value contracts that depend on various types of cumulative gains. I've mentioned one or two examples of cumulative gains. Others would include, for example, defaults in a large basket of bonds or other securities, debt securities, or aggregate insurance claims over a given period, or, for example, the total GDP over a given time horizon, or the total rainfall, that's another example, total mortgage prepayments, that's an important one, and so on and so forth. There's a sense in which the value of an insurance contract calculated in this way tells you the reserve that needs to be allocated, the reserve in the sense that this is what, at least in principle, another party would be willing to receive if they were then to take over responsibility for dealing with the subsequent claims. Now let me turn to another example. I'll go back to the world of the Brownian bridges and the sort of simpler mathematics associated with that. So far we've made the usual somewhat idealized assumption that that one's working in a market where all the market participants have equal access to information. But I don't need to ramify the fact that there may be and indeed are often situations where this isn't quite the case. So one can ask what happens in situations where some of the traders are more informed than others. Well, intuitively, this is a situation which one would like to model, but how do you go about modeling this explicitly and in a way where the mathematics is neat and where you can kind of get your hands on the calculations and work things out explicitly. Using device of information processes, it's possible to pursue this. So let's look at a particular example. So we're going to take the case, this is a very simple example, we'll take the case of a single cash flow, which delivers an amount X at time T. And we can think of this as a kind of bond that is paying off some random payment, maybe a defaultable bond. And we'll introduce two classes of traders. So we'll have the general market trader who has access to an information process relating to the random variable X. But we'll also assume that there are one or more informed traders who have access, let's say, to two or more information processes concerning the same payout. So roughly speaking, we would like to think that the informed trader has a better estimate of the true value of the bond. Now, he can't quite say that the value that he's going to calculate using this extra information is the actual market price of the bond, because clearly the market price of the bond is going to be, you know, where it's generally traded by the majority of the traders who are trading with the more limited amount of information. So the real question is, can the informed trader, since he's on average more knowledgeable than the general market participants, can he in some way take advantage of the situation and seek out what we'll call in quotation marks statistical arbitrage opportunities? That's to say, some way of making a profit out of the situation. So the answer, well, the intuition says, well, clearly this must, the answer must be yes, but how can we go about constructing an explicit example? So we'll assume for simplicity that the informed trader operates on a small scale. He doesn't want to be noticed, and so he never deals, you know, very much, and doesn't, in particular, doesn't influence the market by the trades that are undertaken. So here's an example of a simple strategy. We'll consider this strategy and let it operate both at the level of the general trader as well as the informed trader. So we're going to consider a trading strategy over the time interval from 0 to big T, and at some designated time, little t, in the interval, the ordinary market trader will purchase a digital bond, a bond that either pays out 1 or 0, if and only if at time little t, the bond price, B, is greater than some amount, which I'll call K times the discount function, for some specified threshold K. So the strategy is a very simple one. The trader simply waits until time little t. If the bond price is greater than KP, then he buys the bond and sits on it. If it's not greater than that value, then he doesn't buy the bond. Now, the informed trader will follow exactly the same rule, but in quotation marks makes a better estimate for the value of the bond, and therefore only purchases the bond if the value of the bond, according to the information that he has, is greater than K times P. So his strategy will be different from that of the general market trader, and in particular will be a more well-informed strategy, because he's using more information in order to determine whether to buy the bond or not. But in either case, the bond that is purchased will be held to maturity. Now, to see that this leads to a statistical arbitrage opportunity for the informed trader, you can make the following sort of calculation. We'll assume that the initial position of the trader is 0. So what this means is, so this is the usual sort of start with 0 and then borrow money in order to finance the position and so forth. So if you're going to purchase the bond at time little t, then this means you have to borrow the value of the bond at that time. And then you have to repay the amount at time big T. So you take the discount function, you divide B by the discount function. That tells you the amount with interest that you have to pay at time T. So this means that the ordinary market trader's portfolio at the maturity date will have the following value. First of all, there'll be an indicator function on whether the value of the bond was greater than KP or not. That determines whether he did the trade. And then the amount that is made is the difference between the terminal value of the bond and the amount that has to be repaid to the bank when the story is over. On the other hand, if we consider the terminal value of the informed trader's portfolio, well, that's given by similar expression. So it's the difference between the indicator function of the informed valuation of the bond being greater than K times P. But on the other hand, the arbitrageur can still buy the bond at the market price. So he buys it at the value B, and then at the end of the trade, he has to pay back simply B divided by the discount function. So we have two different portfolios. So now we can consider the value of a security that delivers a cash flow that is essentially given by the difference between the values of the two portfolios of the trader, the informed trader and the market trader. And we want to calculate the value of this security. If we can show that the value of this security is positive, then we've shown that we have a statistical arbitrage opportunity. So in particular, the calculation proceeds as follows. Essentially, it's a simple application of the tower property. So G is the filtration generated by the information accessed by the informed trader. So the conditional expectation of the payout of this difference security is given by the expectation of the expectation conditional on the information available at time t to the informed trader. But if we do that calculation, then we find that this is given by the difference between the two indicator functions times the difference between the two bond prices. The difference between the bond prices emerges when we take the conditional expectation of X given the information in the informed trader's portfolio. But on the other hand, if you look at the product of this expression, if B tilde is greater than B, then this product is non-negative, whereas if B tilde is less than B, then this product is non-positive. And so it follows that the conditional expectation of delta V is non-negative, and therefore the expectation is positive. On the other hand, we know that the present value of the payoff of the strategy of the general market trader, the one who has no special information, that has to be zero, because after all, the general trader doesn't have any arbitrage opportunities, and so if he just does a random trade based on money that he's borrowed, then the amount of money that he has to borrow in order to do the trade is equal to the value of the trade. So we conclude then that the informed trader can execute a transaction at zero cost that nevertheless has positive value. And this is what we mean by statistical arbitrage. Now, at first that sounds a little bit paradoxical. How can you execute a transaction at zero cost that has positive value? We're told in finance that this is impossible. But of course, that's only the case if all market participants have the same information. But if some market participants have preferred information, then they can execute trades at zero value, at zero cost, that nevertheless have a positive value. And that's what we mean by a statistical arbitrage. Well, that brings me to the conclusion of my talk. What I've attempted to do here is to give you some ideas about recent work that have been carried out in the pricing of assets using information as the sort of driving idea, with various examples from credit and equity and from insurance, and ultimately to statistical arbitrage. Thank you very much.